Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos.
And I'm Amanda Nduka. And for this episode, we have the director of this upcoming Netflix holiday film, Jingle Jangle.
Celebrate the holidays.
Yeah. So Dave E. Talbert, you guys. It's on Netflix. It is a feel-good holiday movie. It's one that we haven't really gotten in a long time. And it is a cast of people of color, Black folks. Forest Whitaker is the main character. And it's
Felicia
super cute.
Rashad.
It's a super cute amount. It's about this little girl who basically like saves Christmas.
Yeah. It's very old-timey Hollywood. You could tell it was shot on a soundstage and it's just happy. It's
a lot of elaborate elaborate dance scenes and music. And yeah, it's really feel good. And like we make this joke during the podcast. David, his last three movies have been Christmas themed movies.
So he said that this ends his trilogy. I don't think it will. I think he's gonna make another one.
Yeah. We need a
he's the Christmas guy.
He's an auteur of holiday films.
It's just a fun movie. And you know, we did tape this before last week. So, you know, before the election.
Yeah.
I think this will add to the joy.
I think so too. If you're feeling joy right now. I mean, there might not be.
Well, you should be. And if you aren't, then while you're listening to this podcast, because you're not our demo.
Anyways, without further ado, here is David. David, welcome to Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for being with us. So we're here to talk about your movie.
Jingle Jangle.
Coming on Netflix November 13th. But before we get to that, I want to ask, how are you doing? Like, how are you, how's everything for you right now?
Well, I was doing good until this chair just, angry chair. No, everything's good. You know, crazy time, but it's a time to discover some things that you might not have discovered if you were running around, you know, 50 miles an hour. So, it's been a good creative time, you know, for me. And
hobbies?
Yeah, well, taught my son how to tie his shoes. I didn't know how to do that. it's good.
Okay, good.
Are you in LA right now? Where are you right now?
I'm in LA.
Okay.
Yeah, I just painted my office 2 days ago, so I haven't hung anything back up. I wanted a fresh coat. At the end of every project, I have to go through this mass kind of cleaning.
Interesting.
Next phase kind of thing.
I always do it because ideas for me, they don't come in clutter. There was a saying that I said that your ships come in over calm seas. And so my creative ships come when it's calm and clutter free, and then I can receive them.
Okay.
So a little Zen, a little Deepak Chopra-ish.
That's kind of cool. Like cleansing
and you've done that. You've done that your whole career.
Oh, every time. I mean, my wife laughs at me because she knows what's coming. I'm gonna paint. I'm gonna reframe. I'm gonna buy some new stuff. She knows what's coming, so she just anytime you've been in such a big undertaking like this project.
Yeah.
Has been for as long, you have to kind of clear it out and invite what was new to come.
You know? I love that. I love that.
Yeah. I might do that practice.
No, see, especially after this year, right? Like that would be a good idea to do after 2020, like get rid of sort of what we can. Mm-hmm. But for you, Dave, we like to talk about people's journeys into this business. I want to start off by asking you, like, I know you went to NYU Film School, but what was your sort of your spark into coming into this business? What made you want to become a writer, director, filmmaker?
Well, NYU was after I got into the business, but it was, I was a radio announcer during college and out of college. And So when I graduated from Morgan, they transferred me to their sister station in San Francisco, KSOL. So I was out there, and then someone, I was calling myself Big Daddy on the air. And the program director said, don't call yourself Big Daddy because it's offensive to women. And I said, in our community, it's a term of endearment. I said, there's nothing offensive about it. He said, well, just don't do it. So next time I opened up the radio, the mic, because of course I was 22 and defiant and in the Bay Area and had learned all about the Black Panthers growing up. So why not be defiant? If there's any other place to be defiant, then it's in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
So I said 107.7 KSOL, the Bay Area's best variety of music, always at least 20 in a row, continuous music station, is Big Daddy.
Okay.
Hotline went off. I'm like, uh-oh. And next day I said, hey, he said, didn't I tell you not to call yourself Big Daddy? I said, yeah, but I said, I got to be honest with you. It's who I am, though. And he said, well, then I got to be honest with you. You're fired.
What? So,
wow.
And that's how I got fired. And I was the biggest DJ at 22 in the Bay Area. And so I went on unemployment. And those were great checks. Every Thursday, $425. I never imagined that there was free money that would come. And I knew the mailman by name. His name was Andrew. And I would say, hey, Andy. He said, hey, Dave. Give me that check. And one day the checks, I got there and he was loading in the mailbox, and there he finished and he said, hey, have a great day, Dave. I said, hey, wait, where's the check? He says, oh, there is no check. I'm like, what do you mean there is no check? He says, David, you do know these run out, don't you? So,
you're like, I have to get a job now.
And so I got depressed for a minute because I knew the first month was on its way and I had no $425 checks. And so someone gave me tickets to a play. And I had never gone to see a play before. And it was The Diary of Black Men by Thomas Melanson at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. And I went there and people were just going crazy. And I was looking at the stage, I was looking at these wonderful people, the 3,000 people. And I said, oh, I can do that. And I went home and started writing my first play. And then a year later, we found someone to invest in it. And we put it up at the Black Repertory Group Theater in Berkeley, California. 300 seat theater. We sold out 18 shows in a row.
This is your first play?
First play. But I knew comedy really well. Okay. And I knew dialogue growing up in the church and listening to my great grandmother and uncle preach every Sunday. I understood words. I understood how words moved people, touched people, connected with people, changed people's lives even. So we put it on and then we went on tour about 6 months after it opened up, and that's how the play business began.
Oh, I didn't even know you were from the Bay Area. I lived there for 10 years before moving to LA.
Oh man, the Bay is good. It's fine. The Bay is wonderful. There's something in the water, in the air, and it's just so creative and inspiring and progressive.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that I started there.
Yeah, it's expensive.
Well, now it wasn't there. Once Starbucks and Poodles and white people came into
it. No, it's true. Did you live in Oakland?
I lived in Oakland, and I mean, you could buy a house there for $3.
But there. Now it's like, whatever happened in San Francisco spilled into Oakland.
Starbucks and a poodle is all over.
Starbucks and a poodle.
Gotta go. So you started out writing plays. Was it always in your plans to do film?
No, it wasn't. It was just plays, and they were very successful. The genre of urban theater was new. There were two big guys, Shelley Garrett and Mike Matthews. Shelley Garrett did Beauty Shop. That was a big play. And then I came in as young kid. I mean, they were both 20, 25 years older than me. And I came in at 25 years old with a play. and we toured it across the country, and it became the biggest comedy in the country. But after 4 or 5 years, someone said, you know, they have this accelerated film school over at NYU. And so I'm like, okay, I'll move to New York and stay in a hotel in Manhattan. I mean, I was making a lot of money with plays. So I just was young and single and like, okay, let's go have some fun.
Live your best life.
Yes,
yeah, do it.
Yeah, so I went there to NYU. And that was a 8-week accelerated, no, 10-week accelerated film course. Wow. And, but you know, I didn't, I saw a girl in the class that I really liked and I chased her around New York for 10 weeks. And so I didn't pay attention to not one thing that went on in that class. And, so.
Well, no, well, you paid attention to something.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got,
yeah.
Well, did you end up like dating or anything or no?
No, it was near miss, but we became great friends.
Okay, good.
We became great friends and still are great friends, but okay, no.
Okay, good. Yeah.
But had a great time in Manhattan and taking in New York, and it was wonderful. But that was my first experience with film. Yeah, first experience.
Yeah. So like when you were, you know, I guess even when you were growing up or just like even like coming up as a writer or a playwright, when was the first time that you felt that you saw yourself represented in a play or a TV show or a film or just in media in general?
Well, as a playwright, it was seeing Diary of Black Men, because these monologues and the commercial said, "How do you love a Black woman?" Mm-hmm. And so listening to men and their vulnerability and expressing, you know, their affection, that was powerful. And then sitting in a theater and seeing 3,000 Black people all dressed up enjoying this, that you know, I grew up in a storefront church, and storefront church means there's, you know, there's on the roll usually have 50 members, but every Sunday is about 12, 13 people that are your favorite.
I'll show up during Easter and Christmas.
yeah. And, but it was that, you know, but the earliest cinema for me was Superfly that I remember of Blackness. I remember, and my parents weren't together and my mother wouldn't let us see it. And I remember my father, one of the few times he picked up my brother and I, he said, "Hey, want to go see a movie?" I'm like, "Yeah, okay." So we go in there and it's Superfly. And I'm like,
wow.
And I remember the bathtub scene with Superfly and Sheila Frazier changed my life. Mm-hmm. I think that's when I realized I was a man. I think I went from a boy to a man.
Wow.
There you go.
During that bathtub scene in Superfly. And I had a chance to become friends with Sheila Frazier years later, and it was hard for me to look at her in the eyes. I would turn away and look at her because that she was, I told her. She was that. She was that.
She was that. There you go.
Do you model your career, or have, do you look up to people, like, or do you have anybody that you want to model, you want to like model your career after, or even like growing up, and were there people that you aspired to be? Or you look
as a writer, even before I was a writer, the writer that spoke to me the most was Neil Simon.
Okay.
Mm.
And I loved just his stories of life, love, human condition, of family, and the rhythm of his dialogue spoke to me. When we toured my first play, Telling It Like It Is, we toured in Richmond, at the Richmond, the Carpenter Center in Richmond, and the newspaper, Richmond Times Dispatch was their big newspaper there, and they said the first line of my first city in my touring play said, "The audience roared with laughter that would make Neil Simon envious." I'm like,
oh, there you go.
Nothing right there. Yeah. You know, they spoiled me.
Wow.
But it's Neil Simon. And then I got a chance to discover August Wilson. And it was a piano lessons I went to in San Francisco. And that, the lyricism, the rhythm and style and poetry and just, I mean, it was like people were singing a song with dialogue. And I'm like, well, what manner of alien is this man? Who is this? All? So now I just started watching all the, going to see all his plays, Fences and Ma Rainey, Black Bottom. And then years later, got a chance to sit down and talk to him. Wow. And he was like a mythological figure, like I was talking to one of the greats. But yeah, so I would say it would be Neil Simon and August Wilson.
Yeah. Oh, dope. Yeah. So like, you know, you've written plays, and then, you know, how was that transition into like kind of playwriting and then like going onto screen or going to film? And since being in film, how have you seen the industry change from your very first film all the way up until Jingle Jangle?
Well, the first film was I would call like a student indie that I shot right after right after the NYU experience. You can imagine how horrible that film was. I never went to class. So, I mean,
can we watch it somewhere?
No one is ever going to watch it because no one would ever hire me. But the script was on fire because we had everybody in it. Tyra Banks. This was okay. In 95. So it was Tyra, Malik Yoba, Nabuche Wright, Sherry Headley, Chip Fields, Morris Day, Gary Dordain, Karen Parsons. So we had a star-studded cast.
That was a good age.
John Amos was in there. And the script was on fire. But I mean, you could have thrown me in director's prison because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Because I'm a theater director, everything is a master shot, a proscenium, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it with my eyes and saying, and I remember the first time I'm like, man, that was wonderful. And the DP said, you might want to look into the monitor and see what you shot. And I'm like, whoa. And so I didn't know what I was doing, but that was that. But then when I really did the first film, which was First Sunday, it was still a kind of an homage to growing up in Holiness Church, Evangelical Church, and about how there are good people that do bad things, and then there are bad people that do good things. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of, it's not so, you know, there's a grayer, it's not so black and white in judging people. But it wasn't necessarily a cinematic experience as much as it was the heart and soul and comedic. And I'm very proud of that. And that was at Screen Gems. And you know, it was at that time, you would, if you got a chance to do a black movie, they would open it up in Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. Mm. And it was the event for the black community. We opened up $500,000 short of being number one that weekend. It was the bucket list that beat us, which was Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson. And they were on twice as many screens as us. But I was proud of that. But you know, you were gonna open up on Dr. King's weekend. You were gonna have, they had the formula where you, if you did 15 million or 20 million of black movie and it was DVDs, there was no way you were gonna lose. So there was a ceiling. Mm-mm. And that pretty much continued. And my next film was, Baggage Claim, another $11 million movie. If you do it at a price, black images don't travel. It's only going to open up well in Atlanta and DC and Detroit and Chicago. So that's all we're going to give you. And then it was Almost Christmas, which another amazing cast. You're going to get only a certain amount of money, and you've got to make sure it opens up in Atlanta and DC and Detroit and Chicago. And then I did El Camino Christmas, which was a small indie film that Ted Melfi wrote and asked me to direct for him. And then we get to Jingle Jangle.
Yeah.
So you say, what is the difference between where I started? Well, they usually tell me, you got $2. We love your script. We think this is one of the best scripts we've read. And I think it could do really well. You got $2.
And make sure it plays well. They still
play notes.
Martin Luther King Jr. weekend.
Absolutely.
It plays well in Atlanta and Chicago.
Absolutely.
And DC and
Detroit. $2.25, then that 25 cents is on you. You do understand that.
You got to cover that 25 cents. We ain't going to help you there.
and that's what it was. And cut to Jingle Jangle, which is on the shoulders of all of the amazing work that Spike Lee was able to do and kind of revitalizing and making a market and making the stories not only critically acclaimed, but commercial successes. And then there was this wave of course, the 90s movies that, and then there was the big one that was kind of the shot heard around the world. I don't know which one came first, but it was Get Out with Jordan Peele and Black Panther with Ryan Coogler.
Right.
And I remember when I went to see Get Out, and you know, you go to see scary movies, but you can leave after 5 minutes if you want to see black people because they're going to be killed. They're going to be killed in the first 5 minutes.
First 5 minutes, yep.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's always a guy named Kenny, Black Kenny, in all the horror films. And Kenny is not going well.
Kenny is very unfortunate. He doesn't have the best.
If you see a script and his name is Kenny,
you don't want to.
You're done.
he wasn't going to make it. But that film was so poignant and powerful.
Yeah.
And then it did exceptionally, the commercial business. And then like, whoa, wait a second. You can put black faces in horror films. They can live past 5 minutes and people will go out and see it. And he made that genre not about the faces, but about the story, the content. Mm-hmm. And everyone embraces it. And then Black Panther comes out. And, you know, you couldn't find a Black Panther action figure in no Disney store. No. But they said, okay, well, we're going to do this and we're just going to do whatever. But
right.
I knew that it was going to be a cultural phenomenon. I knew that, look, I pulled out my closet. I pulled out my African garb. I went with my son and we're going here. Look,
you're
here.
Awesome.
We are here. I'm the king of Zamunda. And you are a king.
Yeah, we fought for those tickets. Like, we have to be at that premiere.
It didn't matter what country you were from. If we were from Zamunda, it didn't matter, fictitious or whatever. We were fine in whatever African garb we had on, and we were there. And the film went on to do over $1 billion globally because it wasn't then about the faces in front of it. It was the content. It was the excellence, the level of excellence that these the filmmaker put into it and the actors in this world. So those were the two movies that, in my mind, that really started to shift that, it's not about black or white, it's about green. And that in the UCLA article that came out, that studios are actually losing money by by not having representation.
Right.
And so here we come now. I go in the office at Netflix with Scott Stuber and Nick Nesbitt and simply told them about holidays and watching Christmas films with my son, who's 7 years old now. And I said, we love Christmas. I said, and people of color love the holidays.
Yeah.
I said, but every holiday, we have nothing to watch with anybody that looks like us. There's no representation of anybody. We have to watch Jolly Old Nick. He's got to have rosy red cheeks. He's got to have a white beard, and that's what it is.
Yeah.
And I said, imagine the people of color around this world, that if there was some representation, how much they would enjoy that.
Yeah.
And what it would mean. And Scott Stuber said, I never thought about that, but you're right, David. And we need to do something about that.
Isn't that crazy that people, I always question people that when you tell them something like this, like how is that something that you haven't thought about? Like, I don't know. I kind of feel like maybe because we are black and we kind of are more aware of the lack of diversity that we see, especially in genres like Christmas movies, Christmas adventure movies. But like a lot of people, it's surprising that when you tell them this thing or you confront them with this, it's like, oh, I didn't even know that. So yeah. I don't know. It's just, it's like,
I think it's just a blind spot in the industry. Yeah. And, you know, going to that study about the UCLA thing, I wrote that up for Deadline and I was like reading through this and I was like, And it was pretty eye-opening.
I read yours. That's when it came across my feed. I'm like, whoa, what's
it's kind of beautiful. And it's like, all I think a lot of us are people of color, queer community have been saying, you know, diversity sells, and right. people are craving these kinds of stories. And isn't it kind of amazing how like it took Get Out and Black Panther to make people realize, hey, the Black community could just do something beyond, you know, they could tell other stories besides right. the one you exactly. want them to tell. Yeah. And then, like, I think Black Panther paved this way for, like, other people, like Crazy Rich Asians came around the same time. That became one of the highest grossing rom-coms of, like, 10 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, unfortunately, we haven't seen, like, a Latinx, you know, big movie or, mm-hmm. you know, an indigenous movie yet, but I mm-hmm. hope we're on the way there.
Yeah, yeah. And with Jingle Jangle, would you say that this is sort of kind of what Jordan Peele did for Get Out and Black Panther? This is sort of putting Black people at the center of a holiday adventure movie that we don't really, I was trying to think of comparisons when I was watching it, and I was like, you know, this movie's giving me Cinderella, Brandy,
yes,
and version. But that was still, I mean, that was a great like mixed cast. But thinking about like having like Black people at the center, and it's an adventure movie. It has magic in it. It has like all these sci-fi elements. It was just really fun to see that type of film that like, I feel like I can watch with my nephews, you know, mm-hmm. or my nieces during. So this took you 20 years in the making, right? Mm-hmm. This project.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to comment that, you know, the Crazy Rich Asians. It says, oh, Asians fall in love too. Oh, right. You know, that's what a novel idea. Oh, yeah.
They're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Same thing with Black people like Christmas or holidays. And,
yes, exactly.
What it does is it normalizes, you know, it was very intentional in the representation. This film, Jingle Jangle, is very intentional in its representation, but yet it has nothing to do with race.
It doesn't.
Or color. Yeah.
It has humanity in heart. And it normalizes that, oh, wait a yep. second. Oh, people of color, oh, they have families and have the same issues and enjoy. And so it normalizes. And those films, they normalized that we're all collectively as a community. It's about not the Black or white or brown or Asian experience. It's about the human experience, and that's what connects us all. And right. and you know, I got great respect for Netflix because they're a global brand. So they're in 191 countries around the world. So they understand 32 languages. They understand that they're not just programming for Atlanta and DC and Chicago and Houston. Right. They are, but they're not just. Exactly. So they understand that they want something that speaks to this kind of global audience. And the 20 years that it took me 20 years to sit in a room with two people mm-hmm. that saw there was a hole, and they were bold enough to say, well, let's fill it. You know, mm-hmm. let's patch it up. And this whole tapestry of holiday films, there was this gaping hole in there. And they said, well, let's go fill it up and let's sew it with some soul. And that's what they did. And you know, the industry has changed. Hopefully this will be a reset button for, not hopefully, it will be a reset yeah. button for holiday films. You will, just like if you see a Marvel film and you don't see the general, or you don't see Little Sister, mm-hmm. or Black Panther, God rest Chadwick. So if you don't see them in the Marvel film, you're like, well, where's the general? What's wrong? So they're making it normal now. And I think that's the beauty of where film is going now.
Yeah. Also have to say, I got a kick out of watching Forrest dance Afrobeat. I was like, okay.
Forrest got that old Black man at the family reunion.
I see y'all.
I love Forrest Whitaker.
Yes.
That man is a force of nature. And he has so much love and humanity and joy just in his spirit. And he's a big kid. You don't think of when you see Forrest, you know, playing Edie Bean and all the characters.
He's intimidating a little bit when you
You think of this like huge thespian and like he's like very serious. Like and you just described like everything you described him kind of describes the whole film. It's like joyous. There's just this like magic about that was just bought with the story.
Yeah, that dance though, in the forest. That's gonna be on TikTok. That is hilarious.
I got excited. I got up from my seat when the dance happened. So this isn't your first musical, right? Like have you written musicals in play form?
Well, the plays, I toured 14 plays. 10 of them were musicals.
Okay.
I've been playing around with music for 30 years in plays. So, but just had never shot one as a film.
Yeah. So how was the experience though, getting to actually put one on film? Like, was that?
Oh, it was great. It was great. It's easy. You know, look, I pulled Phil Lawrence. Phil Lawrence, who wrote all the Bruno Mars songs with Bruno. Now, Phil has sold probably over 100 million records worldwide. He has 8 Grammys. I mean, he understands not only music that's soulful, but that music that speaks to the world and that the world bobs their head to. And then I brought John Legend in to produce and write, music for the film too, whose music is around the world. It's global. So it was the first step was to have these great songs.
Yeah.
And then you cast great singers. You know, Forrest went to school for singing.
That's my girl.
Yeah, and Anika Noni Rose.
Oh God, Anika.
Sent you up under the
her moment. I was just like, I love Anika.
Chills with Anika. I mean, that woman, I've been a fan of hers for forever. And that woman, when she sings Make It Work in that town square, you can forget about
No, you can't.
And Madeline Mills, who we discovered, whose voice is just like an angel. She's like a little angel singing to you. And Miss Johnston and Keegan-Michael Key. Nobody know Keegan could sing. And he's killing Magic Man G.
Definitely. So what is it with Christmas films? Because your last 3 films have been Christmas films.
Well, it's funny. I didn't plan it to be that way. Almost Christmas, I wrote that it was called A Myers Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And when we sold it to Universal, Packer said, baby, that's Packer. Packer's like the mayor of the world. Packer's like, hey, baby, I love your script. Baby, we're going to do this. We at the big studio now, baby. Just need one thing, baby. I love it. I love it. I love it. We need to make it Christmas. And so we made it, it changed from Myers Thanksgiving to, it was a Myers Christmas. Then they changed it to Almost Christmas. Mm-hmm. And then I just was going through to a general meeting at Netflix and Ted Melfi, who I had known, I showed up there. I was coming out of the elevator and on the other side of the elevator, this is when the building was in Beverly Hills. I saw a hand stop at the door and, you know, Ted did Hidden Figures. He wrote and directed Hidden Figures. Mm-hmm. And so a hand came out and it was Melfi. And he says, DT, I was like, Melfi, what you doing here? He says, I'm just taking a meeting. He said, what you doing here? And I said, I got to take a general meeting here. And he says, yeah, man. He says, I got a film I'm doing over here at Netflix and I'm doing one at Warner Brothers so I can't direct it. So we're here trying to figure out who's going to direct it. And he looked at me and says, holy shit, DT, you're going to direct it.
Wow.
And I said, Melvin, what are you talking about? He said, look, I wrote the script. I want to produce it. It's a go movie. We're shooting in 3 months. You'll be perfect. I'll send you the script this afternoon. I said, Melvin, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, DT. He said, call me after you read it. So I read it. And of course, Melfi's a beast of a writer. Yeah, so I loved it. So that's how I got that gig. Now that script was called El Camino. Mm-hmm. Then they changed it to El Camino Christmas. It had nothing to do with Christmas. So I go from first, it was Myers Thanksgiving. They changed that to Almost Christmas. This movie was just called El Camino. They changed it to El Camino Christmas. And now I'm the Christmas dude. Yeah.
Technically Jingle Jangle was from the start Christmas. So this is
It was set during that time. But it wasn't called, then it was called Jingle Jangle the whole time. And then they changed the title Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey.
So you're gonna be forever known.
You're just gonna
make Christmas movies.
You're gonna be the holiday film director.
I'm Black Santa. I mean, if you just, I'm officially Black Santa, and you know, I just dye the beard white for the holidays, and my cheeks are pretty rosy, and then there you go. But the holidays are a wonderful time, and it's a wonderful time filled with heart and soul and a lot of pain also during the holidays. So it gives me a chance to explore, you know, those things as well.
I think, so like, I watched it like through last night, and last night, as everyone knows, was a night because someone got confirmed or whatever, but we won't talk about that. But it bought, like, you know, I was looking up at it, it bought this like certain amount of joy and like an escapism at the same time, very grounded.
Feel good.
It reminded me of like, you know, these old timey Christmas musicals, and what we get to see black and brown faces. And did you, because it felt very like, was it all shot on a soundstage, or what did you like go? Because I felt like that, and I like that feeling. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wanted to feel like the old MGM musicals, you know, and Oliver and things that you saw full in the Disney classics, like, you know, Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Mm. You saw full body dancing. Mm. And so it was intentional in that. And we brought in Ashley Wallen, who choreographed The Greatest Showman, to as our choreographer. And I told him I wanted to full body choreography. Mm. I wanted it to, you know, and we wanted it to be in a set that didn't feel like a set. So we shot it the same place they did Aladdin, a place called Arborfield. Mm. That's what we shot. And then we did, you know, some exteriors to open it up, like the snowball scene and all that stuff. That was in a real town of Norwich that we shot. But it was important to, for scope, you know, and when I talk at some of the films, even Crazy Rich Asians, well, look at the scope of that film. You've never seen, you know, it'd been the Joy Luck Club, which is an amazing movie, but these are all contained small movies. You didn't see scope and grandness like that. And that's what I wanted to make sure was in this film, was scope and the production quality and the production design and the costume design and the visual effects and all of that stuff. I wanted you to feel like you were in a major event movie that happened to have people of color. You weren't in a people of color movie.
That
happened to be an event.
Yeah. There was no Kenny in this movie. There was no Kenny.
No, one black Kenny. He was waiting there, you know, he slid in my DMs and said, what's up? You know, so I got to put Black Kitty in some movie.
I mean, you've definitely come, because it did feel super, you know, traditional in that sense, but also at the same time felt super modern. Mm-hmm. And you kind of answered my next question, or you actually answered the couple questions about, you know, what did you look to inform the look? And, you know, you mentioned the Disney, the MGM, this like kind of old Hollywood charm. And did you grow up on those, or like, did you always kind of, were those kind of some of your favorite kind of holiday movies? And
I'm Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Willy Wonka all day long.
I haven't seen that in such a long time.
All day long. And that's what I grew up. I know all that. I know every single song from Dick Van Dyke sung in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Willy Wonka. My son, when he was born, we stenciled up on his wall, there is no place I know that compares to pure imagination.
There
will be free if you truly wish to be. And so I sat down with my son when he was four, and I'm like, we're gonna watch Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, man. You watch my favorite song, my favorite movie. He's like, yeah, daddy, I wanna watch it. So we sit there with popcorn, and I'm just watching and singing, crying. I'm like, my child over right in front of me. I look at him, and he was staring at the screen, trying to figure out, well, what could he wrap his mind around? And he's like, well, can I play with my Legos? I'm like, you ain't playing no damn Legos. You don't watch the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Like, I watched when I was a kid. He's like, okay. And then he just started drifting off and everything. I'm like, go ahead and play with your Legos, man. Experience for me.
Oh, he's not a fan.
And then I realized that he couldn't relate to anything on the screen. There were that Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, I didn't realize, is the whitest movie perhaps ever made. Yeah. And these kids were the happiest little British, pure British kids. And it's a beautiful, wonderful movie. Yeah. But there is no representation any way, shape, or form. And that's when I realized, I said, oh, that's my nostalgia, because we had no other option when I was growing up. You had no other option of inclusivity. It was only The Wiz was the one outlier that came along, but they were all grown people in Wiz. Yeah. And I loved it and it was wonderful, but where are the children in this movie? Mm-hmm. And so I realized that representation, he wanted to see someone that looked like him, because we had just not too long ago gone to see Miles Morales in Spider Universe. And he's Miles Morales all out.
Yeah.
And then it connected to me why he loves Miles Morales. Because he looks like him.
Right.
That is such a good point.
That was how my little cousin, he connected so much to Black Panther. Like it was his everything. Black Panther is his everything. But like in terms of the other Marvel films, it's like he liked them, but when it came to Black Panther, it was a different relationship he had to it. It's something that I guess we don't think of, but this is something important for people to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's that's such a good point, is because like a lot of us grew up on this dominant culture where white culture was the standard, and that we had no choice. But then now this younger generation, I'm like jealous of them, because they get to actually see, but then you show them something that we grew up with, like you did, and they're like, what the fuck is this shit?
They want no parts of it. Yes. And I love that that's where films are going. I love the representation. Yeah. I love that we're in a place where studios see that it just makes good business sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can be, wait a second, I can make money and be woke?
Right. Oh, yeah. Right.
Wait a second.
Yeah. It's okay.
What a concept.
Maybe not 10 years ago, but now I think it's okay.
Yeah. Even like this is like a twofer. Yeah. I diversity and make money. What? I'm in.
I mean, there's like just so much to look forward to, you know, and, you know, I am personally excited to like see Shang-Chi and how that will subvert, you know, and I think Shang-Chi is a different one for the Asian community, just because of how that character was created, bunch of stereotypes and anything, but how they're going to subvert that. And then we have In the Heights coming out. I think it's going to be good.
My son and I, we watched Mulan. We had movie night. And it doesn't matter to this generation the color so much. They accept and expect it to look like. My son has friends, his Black friends, his Asian friends, his Indian friends, his white friends. He's all kinds of friends. So they're used to, you know.
They're used to.
Yeah.
Whereas we just grew up with.
No, but it's true. It's true. So definitely. I mean, I don't think that there's any going back.
There is no going back.
It might. You know, Hollywood goes through its waves. We know that this diversity is not the
first. Can't unring the bell.
Yeah.
I mean, like now it's about. I think now is the time to like kind of hold the industry accountable. You know, we were seeing this interesting reckoning, you know, especially after George Floyd's death, and that kind of just reverberated throughout all industries. Mm-hmm. But now it's like there is plenty of virtue signaling, which, you know, I thought was a little bit like, oh, virtue signaling, you're just all talk. But someone pointed out to me that virtue signaling is good, because now we could hold these people accountable who are virtue signaling. They're like, oh, you said you're going to do this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
But it's important for us, though, that what we put out there in the universe, it has a standard of excellence, that it exceeds expectation. Yeah. If Crazy Rich Asians, as great as it was, didn't do anything at the box office, then
which was so sad.
But that is our responsibility as filmmakers, to throw everything but the kitchen sink into the films, but do it with a level of excellence, and surround yourself with people that that are masters of their craft to help evolve, you know, your idea. And that is a heavy responsibility, but we got to carry it.
Yeah.
Because now, once Jingle Jangle works, then you go over to Disney, or you may go to Universal, or then we're not trying to just put a Black person in a white role.
Right.
Yeah.
The excitement is, and oh, they got a Black girl to play Ariel.
Yeah.
Ariel wasn't broke. Oh, they got a Black girl to play Annie. Well, Annie, I'm not mad at giving, but let's make our original one.
That's there
Annie.
You go.
Annie is a little white girl with cute as she can be, with freckles and red hair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, that's what she is.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes with that argument everyone's like saying, as much as I would like to see Idris Elba be James Bond, I was like, oh, why not create another character, Idris Elba, and have him be his own thing and not James
Bond? Now, every woman is going to cancel you after that. I'm gonna tell you something.
I did preface it. I don't mind.
Philosophical to a point. Okay? When it comes to Idris Elba, he is a religion. You cannot
be
canceled out because look.
It's so funny because I did tweet something out that Idris Elba is his own, you know, like sexual preference. Like there's hetero, there's like he's a whole different world.
Yeah, women would be okay if that was a first Bond movie okay that had no dialogue. If it was
I'm still advocating Idris as Bond.
No, I don't mind. Give him Bond and another movie. Look, why not?
You give him Bond, you have no dialogue, you have slow motion
you don't
shots
need dialogue
pushing on his face and unbuttoning that tuxedo.
Or just shirtless the whole time.
One scene, one maybe a steamy like whatever scene, and we're good. That movie can end right there and then, like 5 minutes.
Just show him for 90 minutes on screen making scrambled eggs.
I made the biggest mistake. I'm watching the movie with Idris Elba, and I'm over here trying to comment on the first act break and the second act break, the story arc and the character design. And my wife looked at me and said, "Would you shut up, please?" If you don't want to go see it, if you don't want to see this movie, you don't have to see this movie. You go see something else, but I'm going to sit here and watch this movie. And I don't care about the first act, second act, or any act in this movie.
We just have to play with it.
That's true. You're going to put Idris in it. You know, okay, I will take accountability for what
you
I just
take that
said.
Back, Dino. You don't want that life. Okay. You don't want that life.
We're going to edit that out.
Yeah. So we have Jingle Jangle. It's coming out November 13th.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
What else is next for you that you can tell us? Another Christmas movie?
No, I think I'm three for. I think
that's kind of your trilogy, right?
Yeah.
Your Christmas trilogy.
Right.
It's a Christmas trilogy.
Yeah.
And there'll be a box set.
No, seriously.
But I'm doing building worlds, building another world.
Okay.
I got this whole visual effects kind of world building bag that Netflix allowed me to, gave me the budget. You know, they not only greenlit the film, but they gave me the budget. They gave me all the financial support. So now, you know, you can't unring the bell. So I like world building. I like stories, big diverse stories with inclusion and sharing them with the world. So that's where I am now. That's where I am. I'm not going back.
would you want Jingle Jangle to be even a stage musical, like kind of
that's how it started. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right.
And that's why, and we're already in talks. It's going to be a perennial stage production on Broadway.
Yeah.
I would
love to see
Forest Whitaker into playing Geronicus on the debut, whatever the opening up was. So yeah, it's going to be on stage. You know, it has stage written all over it.
Yeah.
And then also the merchandising from this.
Right. And also shout out Felicia Rashad. We need to mention her.
Oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
I want one. I want one.
Maybe I shouldn't say this, but
the Buddy 3000 is everything.
So we like to wrap up this our interview with this section we call the facts or the FAQs, just fun questions to end this great conversation on. So the first question is, what is one Christmas tradition that you love, and what is one Christmas tradition that you can live without?
What do I love? I love the opening up. My Christmas tradition was opening up a gift on Christmas Eve. And I try to talk my wife now into opening up all the gifts. And she's like, no.
Yeah.
So I love that one. The one I could probably do without is the Christmas cookies that Santa Claus is going to eat. Because my mother, one Christmas, we woke up early and all we saw the crumbs and everything. We came to the tree and we asked where our mother was. And she was in the back. She had a stomach ache because she ate all the, and my uncle said, we're okay, I'm like, what's wrong with mommy? You know, she says, oh, baby, something, you know, mama's just telling me, I'll be all right. My uncle came over. I'm going to tell you this. She ate them cookies. And that's all she wanted. So that ruined it for me.
Oh, God.
So no more cookies.
That's fine.
But my mother ate the cookies.
Okay, so if you could make another musical or even play, let's say, or movie about a holiday with an unlimited budget, what holiday would it be and who would you cast to star?
This can be any holiday.
Any holiday. Isn't that Flag Day?
Yeah.
Any holiday.
Yeah.
Any holiday. It'd probably be Juneteenth. I'm fascinated with that. I'm fascinated with that. The whole celebration. And because I want every woman on the planet to see it on opening weekend, I'm casting Idris Elba in his first non-speaking role. It's a silent movie. And I'm gonna shoot it with about 10 cameras so I can shoot an angle on him at 10 different angles in slow motion.
Let's put that first. Let's make it happen.
That's just gonna Juneteenth the musical starring Idris Elba with no speaking part.
And he doesn't
sing. The whole title.
He's the star of the musical. He doesn't talk or sing. It's perfect. It'll be
one shirtless scene, so we're good.
No, he's just shirtless the whole time, slathered in baby oil, and everyone's.
What is your, do you have a favorite like corny holiday movie?
Mine is, I don't know if it's corny, but it's a Christmas Story.
It's kind of campy, you know.
With like, Ralphie.
Yeah.
That shit is hilarious.
I think that's like the only Christmas movie that I would actually, like they play it like all day on Christmas Day on TBS or wherever. And I will actually sit down and watch it anytime it's on. Just because
it's brilliant. The writing and the narration of it is just brilliant. And my son, he's still now in the pop culture. He says, "I triple dog dare you," you know, and the tongue stuck on it. I mean, it's just so much, so many iconic things in there. I think that's my one.
I think the guy who played Ralphie, isn't he like a producer or a writer? So this is going to be a tough one. If you had to choose one piece of your work that you created to be known for, which one would it be?
It'd be this.
Mm. Oh, quick answer. Nice.
Yeah, this is
your passion project, right?
This is the first time I've got a chance to really, in film or anything, open up my heart fully. And bring kind of the child in me needed this film, and I think the child in us all need this film, and so it would be this one.
Yeah,
I definitely can't wait to watch it with my nieces and nephews.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's perfect timing when it's getting released too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would you rather be held in high regard by your parents or your friends? This is kind of a hard
one. My parents or my friends?
Yeah.
My friends.
I think our parents would always love us. Like, you know, even if it's not, but I feel like friends.
Or they have a version of you that they want you to be.
Right.
You will never meet.
Right.
Yeah. It's like even you could reach the pinnacle of what you want to do and be happy for it, but your parents will just be able like look at you and be all, oh, that's nice. Now take out the garbage, you know, that kind of thing.
I had been doing plays for 20 years. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, you know, come to all the plays. We're selling out. We're 4,000 seaters selling out everywhere. Flew her all across the country. And then she went into a grocery store one day, and I Morris Chestnut and I were on the cover of Jet magazine for one of the, and she called me and she said, "Baby, Mama been praying for you that the Lord was going to bless you in your career and you were going to make it one day. And baby, when I saw that Jet magazine, I said, the Lord done answered my prayers.
Come on, Jet magazine.
That was her.
She made it.
Baby, I bought every Jet magazine in this store.
Love that.
Also, Shesta, who can also be in Idris Elba for us.
Yeah, there you go. He'll star in that musical too.
He's a black piper in the community. Everybody loves Morris.
He should be no dialogue too. It's fine.
Yeah. Our final question, we ask this to all of our guests, is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, writer, producer, creator, that is not in the mainstream that you think people need to know more about and deserves more recognition by Hollywood?
I'd say my wife.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, who is the lead producer of this film, but you know, it's so tough. It's tough being a woman. And then it's tough being married to the director because people perceive you as a plus one.
Right.
A must hire. But she is my must hire because my work wouldn't nearly be as good as it is without her. And people look at her as somebody that I'm bringing along, but that woman has brought me along. When we first started dating, and she saw one of my early plays. We've married 22 years. I mean, you could huff and puff and blow the balls down. I mean, it was, and she came immediately and started changing the aesthetics of my plays and challenging me to write better scripts and challenging me to push myself. And I wouldn't nearly be here. The film wouldn't look like it looks. From the costume design to the production design, all of that, she's painted the hairstyle, Jeremy's hairstyle, that was her. She was going to David, this would look great if it was this. Costume design, she said, you just can't have Victorian style, you have to give African fabric.
I noticed that too.
She got the costume designer to fly to Africa to get authentic, to mix this up. So all of this is her style. And I think, you know, just women don't get enough credit, first of all, just as being women, and how they're driving industries and how they're driving pop culture. And certainly my wife, she is not a plus. If anyone's a plus one, it is me, because there's no way that anything I've done would have turned out the way it has and continues to without that woman's look, touch, and feel. So
I'm spacing on your wife's name. Can you remind
me? Lynn Sisson Talbert. Lynn Sisson Talbert. That's my woman crush. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
7 days a week.
Saturday, Sunday.
365 days a year. Shout out to Lynn.
Shout out.
Again, so much for being here. This was a great discussion.
Yes.
Film, amazing, great family film, much needed. I encourage everybody to watch it, especially during the holidays.
And we look forward to David's next film, next Christmas film, and also the Juneteenth film.
You will not be
and Juneteenth starring Idris Elba.
Idris Elba in a musical, non-speaking, non-singing role.
And a groundbreaking filmmaking.
Thank you again, David.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, y'all.